Welcome to Local Share Green Action Podcast, a show produced by Go Green Locally, a 501c3 nonprofit providing education, tools, experience, opportunities, and support for people looking for more effective action to help our people and planet. Today I'm speaking with Neelam Patil, the driving force behind the creation of multiple Miyawaki forests. Miyawaki forests are densely planted native forests designed to grow up to 10 times faster than conventional forests, quickly becoming thriving ecosystems and powerful havens for biodiversity. Ms. Neelam Patil is a climate literacy and science teacher in California and founder of Green Pocket Forest. She pioneered the first Miyawaki schoolyard forest in North America in Berkeley, earning Time Magazine's Innovative Teacher of the Year recognition. Since 2021, she has led the planting of 9 Miyawaki forests in Berkeley and Los Angeles, as well as in Bangalore, India, empowering youth and communities to take meaningful climate action. Welcome to the show, Neelam.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny, for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. So I'm excited to speak with you and find out more about your path of green action that led you to taking on planning multiple Miyawaki Green Pocket Forest projects in your community. So what inspired you originally to take on some kind of green climate-friendly action initially?
Well, I've always been committed to the planet and very conscientious and aware of it. I also attended film school, and I remember my thesis film was about a heat wave that this mad scientist predicts, and nobody believes her, and she creates this cool suit that's solar powered and nobody wants it, but then the heat wave hits and then they all show up like sweaty zombies at her door. It's like a climate change comedy. It's called Sonia Cools the World. So even in the early 2000s, I was very conscientious of the planet and have been concerned about the planet for a very long time.
Excellent. So what initially inspired you to pursue a Miyawaki forest for your school?
Well, I was teaching my students about climate change, and they sort of told me, Miss Patil, because they called me Miss Patil. I'm the science, elementary science teacher. I was teaching fourth and fifth grade, and they said, Miss Patil, we're tired of learning about this. We want to do something. And so I set about, you know, looking for some solution that my kids could implement, because, you know, these are 9 and 10 year olds and they're already jaded about the planet. They're sort of like, oh yeah, climate change, we've heard about that. And I was like, okay, we have to figure something out here. We can't just let them be so defeated in this. And so I looked around and I found this project. Initially, we had just, my students told me, we want to be like Mr. Beast. I don't know if you've heard of
yes.
Mr. Beast, but
yes.
Yeah, they said, let's do Mr. Beast's thing and let's do Team Trees. So then we started doing Team Trees. And then I found this project that we could actually do at our school, because it was one thing to raise money and send it somewhere where some random place where we don't know what's happening, where the tree's getting planted. We can't even be part of it, versus this Miyawaki forest was something I could do on my schoolyard. And so as soon as I heard about that, I just wanted it for my students. I wanted it for my school, and started this very long process. It took 2 years of steady persistence, engagement, organizing, gaining advocacy, gaining allies within the school system, and forging partnerships across so many different departments that typically don't work together. For example, the Buildings and Grounds Department, which typically is very independent and kind of inert compared to the school and the children and the principal. And then also having to coordinate with parents And so, kind of creating this coalition, and then we also had to get funds. So we were able to fundraise and from some local nonprofits, and they were able to donate, and we planted the first Miyawaki Forest.
So, when you realized how many resources were going to be needed, how did you keep the faith and go on to get all the approvals and funding to carry this out? So, 2 years is a long time. What kept you going?
Well, I didn't realize it was going to take me 2 years. I think that as so I'm neurodivergent, and so I think in a very different way than most people. And I just had this big picture in my head, and I have this tendency to work in very big picture terms. So I just sort of let the, as things sort of started falling into place, that was my dopamine hit, right? So when I got support from the principal or from the parents, and they were writing so letters of support, or I found an ally in the community, that sort of kept me going. And I did not know how many resources it was going to take. And by the time we planted, it was really mind-blowing to see how much of a coalition we needed to build. And when I turn around and tell other people about that, people came up to me after, and they were like, "How did you do this? We've been trying to get this done for 25 years, and we've even offered to pay for it, and we have not been able to get anybody in this school district to budge." And I just said, "I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the right time, or maybe it's me. I'm just persistent."
So,
So.
would you say that when you started to introduce the concept to, well, of course, your classroom, and then the parents of the kids in your classroom, and then kind of reverberating out into the community, would you say that part of the success was really creating a vision for those people first and kind of laying the groundwork before you were really seeking all of the permissions that you needed to move forward?
Absolutely. Education and vision building, establishing that vision was the very first pillar. We couldn't move anywhere without introducing the concept. We actually had a slide deck that we would show. We would make these presentations to the different stakeholders, like the parents, the PTA, the principal, the buildings and grounds. And it sort of, as you said, it started reverberating out and gaining momentum, and it was like a slow but steady movement.
Excellent. And I know you mentioned that the people that had come to you and said, "How do you do this?" We had even offered to pay for it. And I'm sure that since you did that original project, there have been many that have been having that as an issue, not being able to have a funding path. So, in the end, have you found a repeatable funding path for others in other cities to follow, to bring these green pocket forests to their schools as well?
That's a really good question, and the answer is no. And I'd say every project is unique. And since I planted my forest, many people around the country have maybe not too many, but a sprinkling of people have sort of, gone on to just plant something. Maybe they sort of cobbled together some funds for, saplings. They go and dig the, the area, prepare the soil. But there's no, I wish, I would like for there to be. And if anyone's listening to this podcast and wants to support this work, please contact us, because we want to create sort of a institute. We get so many people coming to us, especially with the Time Magazine award. So many people came to me and sort of like, "I want to do this. I want to do this. How do I do this?" And really, funding is the stumbling block for most of them. So my goal is to set up a mini grant program where we can let people apply if they have a site. And if they're not at that place yet where they don't even know the first place to start, then I want to create an institute for, or some sort of a training for those types of people. And all of those, both of these things require, funding and capacity building funding. But then once you get that mini grant, or once you know you want to do it, once you have the land, how do you get the funding? That is a really variable question. And I've had, we've had large corporate donations from some projects, and then other projects, there have been teacher grants that are available where, teachers just get together and they write all these grants, and then we get, some donations from the local business or et cetera. So it's really inconsistent at this time.
Yeah, different avenues, I would imagine, depending on availability.
It's depending on availability and your creativity and your willingness to be brazen for the planet, and shameless, and just ask people for money. And most of the time, if you say, I'm doing this project to plant trees, will you give me some money? People will say yes, but you have to have that confidence too.
So I'm curious, when you're choosing native saplings and other types of shrubs, maybe vine layers, etc., what was your go-to source? And did you look in multiple sources for that decision?
Well, there's data on native plants in almost every state, and in California we have quite a few resources. We have the California Native Plant Society, CNPS, has multiple websites. There's an organization called CalScape, and they have a database of native species, and there are just countless other resources out there to really zero in. And we have an interesting story because I actually invited the founders of the Miyawaki movement to visit from Japan. And so they came to visit Berkeley, and we held a little Miyawaki symposium in July of 2025, and it was a huge success. Over 100 people came just within the Bay Area. When they were here, it's Dr. Fujiwara and Dr. Box. They're both academics and they're both botanists and plant experts. They actually, we got to take them to a old growth forest. They said, take us to a natural forest. And so then they just started doing this plant survey. And so they literally looked at all of the predominant species, and they sort of created this recommended species list while they were visiting on the fly. So it was very, very amazing to watch them both, looking at species in a forest, categorizing them, and then quantifying. This the whole it's called a releve. It's a plant survey, and it's really fascinating to watch them do that. So there's been a variety of sources, and we are coming out with a recommended species list, at least for the Bay Area and most of California, because the Miyawaki forest method, it calls for primarily canopy species, and then a variety of shrubs and subtrees. And so there's a ratio for that, and there's a recommended ratio. And so we're going to be publishing that on our website.
Excellent. And did you partner with any nonprofits or municipalities or companies specifically, or was it just kind of a consortium of different participants?
Every project has been different. So I've done four Miyawaki forests in Berkeley schools, and that was a partnership with the Berkeley school system, and then a couple of different corporate donations. Then there was another project with the city of Berkeley, where they funded it. My work basically inspired a city council member to write legislation, so that I felt really good, and that was awesome. And then they did the forest, and we basically or they passed the legislation, and then they did a formal RFP process, and we applied and we were selected. And so then we got to do the contract. That was amazing. And we just planted that in March, just a month ago. The forest is 1 month old, And then my new school district is in Newark, which is just south of here, about 30 miles. And that school district, we were able to get these teacher grants. So, and that was combined with the PTA raising money and then a variety of local businesses offering us grants and donations. So every, as you can see, every project has been vastly different. And I am because it's interesting to talk about this because I am really wanting to scale this and have, you know, just the way the planet, the direction our planet's going. And we need not just five, we need 5,000 Miyawaki forests. And there's so many elementary schools and schools around the country that lack green space. So these are perfect solutions for that. Now, how is that narrowing down and really, you know, nailing down that pathway to get there? I think this last school that we worked in was a great model where, you know, the teachers got funding, the PTA raised, the kids even did, they donated their own money. They did a fundraiser, and then there's local businesses. I think that's probably the most sustainable, like, sort of, it was more, much more of a crowdsourcing way rather than waiting for like a corporation to be and being at the behest of a corporation.
Did you find a consistency in terms of preparation that you needed to do for the site? Or were there some sites that were much more compacted than others and you had to do some excavations with large equipment? Or kind of what was your approach and how did that work?
Yeah, so the Miyawaki method does call for significant soil preparation and excavation, whether you're using an excavator and digging to, you know, 18 inches, or you're going in with hand tools. And those are all variables as well. The consistency is that the soil preparation is necessary, and it's a very much part of the process, and adding in that compost and really aerating the soil, making the soil fluffy, so fluffy that you can just scoop it with your hand. So in some project we have had to use an excavator. Other projects, the school district was not a fan of us bringing power tools on campus or equipment on campus. In that case, we had to just use hand tools like pickaxes. And even the kids, they have these little mini cultivators that you can see were recently on the news, on the evening news for the latest project on CBS, which you can link here to your podcast. And so people can see, get an idea of the tree planting. And so the kids themselves were using, they were sort of hacking away at the at the soil, and they loved it. They really got a kick out of it. They were like, are we planting again? Can we dig again? Can we dig again? So,
Oh,
you
that's
know,
great.
this soil preparation can be done in a variety of ways. It just has to be done.
Okay. Very good. What were the key steps from idea to planting day, and how much of the work fell on you, students, volunteers, and contractors? If you were to try to give percentages, and I'm sure to some extent there's a lot of variety from which project
Sort of like
you
a play by play of
yeah,
from
just
idea to planting day and the workload.
well, yeah, I think also, you know, when someone else is going to spearhead a project such as this for their school, they're also going to need to understand a little bit more, like how many resources are really going to be coming from them and from the students, and really how much is going to be needed from outside sources, so that they're really walking into it with a more realistic understanding of what's going to be needed.
Well, from basically, like I said, every action, every revolutionary action, like this is truly a revolution of plants in a on a school campus, and you know, really challenging the schoolyard design, which is I always like to say that schools are made to keep humans in and every other species out. There's even language like pest, you know, pest decimation, kind of let's keep the pests out. What does that even mean? That's typically biodiversity. So when you're going to challenge something at such a core level, you really have to be ready to be an educator and to inspire people. So that's the first step. and being ready to educate over and over and over again, whether it's your colleagues, whether it's your kids or the parents or the buildings and grounds crew. So that was really the first step. I'd say that's probably 60% of your job. If you, this is something you have in mind, is to be an advocate and an educator. And then once you have that momentum, once you get the buy-in, then it's the next step is site identification or land acquisition. And that does not mean you're going to acquire land, but that the school is going to give you permission to plant. And typically, the best way to approach that is by pitching them, how are they going to benefit? So, for example, for my latest project, the school itself is short. The buildings and ground staff is very tight. They're very short staffed. They even lost somebody d during the school year. So there is this one area that was running. Basically, the irrigation was always breaking, and it's a huge field. It's like maybe 1.5 acres wide. And so, the buildings and grounds crew said to me, "Okay, well, here's where the irrigation stops. You can have the rest." And that other part is breaking down all the time. We don't want to deal with this anymore. I'm like, great, I'll take it. And so, because I know that once you water a Miyawaki forest for like 9 months, and then the rainy season takes over, you really don't have to water anymore. So that's the next step. So once we have the land, then we can start fundraising. Right. And so then you want to fundraise, and fundraising again, I got my students involved, I got the PTA involved, we had a link, and the kids did this popcorn fundraiser. They just came and gave money, they just gave cash. We sold Otter Pops after school. We did all kinds of little fun, cute little fundraisers. And they raised a little bit, but it was just, I think it was very meaningful for the kids. Like, how cool is that? Like, I get to raise money for a forest at my school. So then there's the fundraising. And then after that, then there's, once you have the money, you have to schedule a planting day, you have to purchase saplings, you have to get compost, you have to get mulch, you have to get all the tools. And then you have to do the planting. And then once the planting is over, you have to mulch because the Miyawaki method calls for mixing the soil really well, but then you want to cover it up and create that little seal of moisture barrier and protection for the soil. So after and planting day is not the end. Okay, so that's the thing, that's where people have the biggest downfall. Like, ugh, I'm finally done. No, you're not done, because you need to make sure you have someone watering. Whether you have irrigation, or if you don't have the money for irrigation, you have a water source nearby and you have a structure. You have some people who are watering every week or 10 days, and when it doesn't rain. And then you also need to create, what we're doing is we're creating a system of internships for high school kids who want to
Nice.
either be in nature, or they need to get service hours, and so they can earn service hours by coming in and weeding. And it's like this self-monitoring internship where they just have to take a picture of their weeds, and then we will sign off on their hours. And so we're sort of integrating all of these, like, already existing structures into place. But a lot of it is, creating new structures, because like, we're not the Red Cross. We don't already just exist, right? You have to just create a lot of this, but people support. We have had hundreds and hundreds of volunteers come out this March for our 3 Miyawaki forest plantings that we have done. And we
Nice.
have done, I've just been blown away at the sheer power of human beings. When they get together and when they want to do something, we can really do a lot of good. And that's what I want to keep focusing on. In today's challenging times, I want to focus on what I can do. Rather, I was telling a friend of mine, I'm not going to focus on who I don't like. I'm going to focus on what I want to do. And if I have time to watch, like, TV or Netflix or whatever, I certainly can have time to plant a Miyawaki forest.
Excellent. Excellent. In terms of the planting material, what were your options? Have more options come along? Was that one of your largest expenses? How did you address that?
Yeah, so definitely saplings are the largest expense, and we have definitely the most time consuming aspect. And whether I always like to say to people, you may have a species list that you have a like a shopping list, but then you have to go and talk to the person who's growing. And they're gonna dictate what you have. It's not the other way around. You cannot think that, oh, I'm just gonna go out and find all these things. So it's really that you are needing to work with your local growers and find out. And so we have definitely expanded our network of growers and through a lot of research and forming relationships, and we found some really great ones. In the Bay Area. Yeah,
The
and the one thing
leaders.
I did want to say is that one other huge cost is the soil preparation. So you need to be prepared for hiring a landscaping crew, whether they have the power tools, whether your school or your city has the okay, is giving you the okay to bring an excavator or something on site. Or if you have to do it with hand tools, and you have to pay people to dig, because either way you cannot work around that. Or maybe you have like a lot of volunteers, but it's really hard work to get volunteers to do that kind of digging. So you really need to be prepared for that cost. So those are definitely the two largest costs, are the cost of soil preparation, hiring a landscaping crew. And then the plants. And
Okay.
mostly compost and mulch, you can get those things donated because people are giving those things away. So that's not those things you should not be spending money on, or very little money on.
And so, what are some of the ways that you and others, your students and community, are enjoying the rewards of your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I keep going back to this recent story on CBS News. If you watch it, you'll see this kid. He is a 7-year-old, and he's definitely enamored with the forest. And I have to say, well, all I can say is that every person, so there's I'll tell you about two different our latest two different projects. One was in South Berkeley, in an area that has typically been deprived of trees, and it's in this area that is on a busy intersection with four or five lanes of traffic, and then there's also the BART, which passes overhead and within just maybe 100 feet of this site. And then there's also a freeway entrance. It's got a lot going on. And I have to say, I was kind of grumpy when I got the site. I was sort of, well, oh, this is what are we going to do with this? But when we planted it, it really transformed the whole space. And that's something amazing that you can say that this is the power of trees. And all of these residents kind of came out of the woodwork to our tree planting, and they were so touched. They were so happy. And these are like people, some elderly people, some families, mostly a lot of elderly people who live in that area. And they just felt so grateful that, and they automatically said, oh, this is a wellness space for us. I'm so excited to meditate here. And I was like, great. I'm glad that you're sort of filling in the meaning for this. And then the other project we did recently was at my school. And I have to tell you, typically kids have to leave. You have to drive like an hour at least to get outside of town, to get to nature, to get to a national park. And a lot of my students, this is a Title I school, and these kids are not able. Some of them haven't even been to the ocean, and they live in Newark, which is like 20 minutes from the ocean. And so to have that nature installation right there on campus is so valuable. And automatically we're seeing kids And when I look at education nowadays, it's like basically I see that kids are trapped in a cell. You know, it's whether it's their classroom is like a box. It is a box, and then they're trapped behind the screen. They have to go on the Chromebooks, you know, for maybe 30 to 50% of their school day. They're on a computer, which is even they're even showing that this is the lowest performing generation since the introduction of technology. And so to see these kids who are very dysregulated by technology and by the current state of education automatically sort of whoosh, you know, just calm down and do a 180. And I saw a different side of my students, all of the hardest kids who are the most jittery and restless and et cetera, they were just so calm and peaceful in the forest. And I was like, yes. And I'll send you like these, I created these project plans that show, you know, the how it will look and an overhead view of this. So I'll send you
Awesome.
those.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'd love to
So
see that.
definitely people are already enjoying it, and everything looks so happy. The plants look so happy.
That's so cool. So, if your ideas, your experience, and your wisdom were all wrapped up in seeds of potential action for you to gift to others, what advice would you give to an aspiring Milwaukee Forest designer, whatever you want to say?
I would say get guidance, you know, get guidance from us, from Green Pocket, get guidance from and find mentors. It's a lot harder than, you know, you think. It's not like, oh, I'm gonna go buy a tomato plant and get a pot and some soil and I'm gonna plant a tomato. It's not that simple. And so it takes such a variety of skill sets and a variety of people skills, financial skills, planting skills, maintenance skills, organizing skills. So build your team and look for mentorship.
Excellent, excellent advice. So as we wrap up, is there maybe one source, a book, movie, or a podcast that has been particularly helpful to you in taking on these projects?
There is a book called Mini Forest Revolution by Hannah Lewis. That is a good primer. And we are also at Green Pocket Forest working on creating an institute or some Milwaukee Forest Academy kind of program so we can empower people. And I definitely encourage people out there wanting to do this at their school to get help, at least for your first couple of them, and even maybe volunteer on a couple of projects that, you know, you're not the captain of the ship, you're just a sailor, and then kind of get your sea legs and then move forward. Don't expect to be, you know, right out of the gate to just even people who are experienced landscape designers and landscapers, architects, they still struggle. There's so many different concepts. So I would say the best thing is to look out and seek for mentorship and build your community.
Excellent,
And
excellent.
unfortunately, there are not that many great resources out there right now. So
Yeah.
I feel a great pull and pressure, not pressure. I feel a great responsibility after 5 years of learning all of this that I've sort of had to gather. There's nobody out there for me really to help me. And we made a lot of mistakes actually. So I feel very responsible. And after Dr. Fujiwara came here, she saw the projects that we'd done. She gave us feedback. We finally are in line with the true application, the true Milwaukee method. And that there's a lot of people out there who say, oh, I'm doing the Milwaukee method. It's because it's a buzzworthy term. And then they just go out and buy whatever native plants they like and plant them densely, and they're not the right species. So don't do that. Don't fall into that trap. And, you know, just wait for some time, and we're going to be putting together sort of crystallizing all of this knowledge that I have been gaining, that's appropriate for the American context, And we'll should be sharing that soon.
Excellent. Well, thank you so very much for taking the time to share this with us and the great work that you're doing and that your community is doing with you.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you for joining us. Check out gogreenlocally.org website to find additional eco action resources and feel free to share a local green event, group, nonprofit, or business in our community sharing directories. You'll also find resources for learning, tools, experiences, and support to live more sustainably and for local projects and initiatives.